when you have a whole room full of single people, at least to my knowledge, the only people in this room that are married is Chelsea and I, no better thing to talk about than marriage, right? Give you some directions for something that you're not even at. No, what I actually figured is that we teach the Bible. We go verse by verse through the Bible. Last week we were in chapter 6, so now we're in chapter 7, which really deals with the issue of marriage, but not just marriage, also the issue of single life. And of course, these are very relevant issues. You ever talk to someone who acts like, who seems to believe that the Bible has no real relevance on life? Like, it's just all these old facts, nothing practical, there's nothing relevant to modern-day life. People seem to have that idea. And yet, here we are dealing with a very relevant issue, and that is marriage. Okay? God knows what marriage should look like, and he knows what singleness should look like. And just so you know, you are in one of those categories. You're either married or you're single, and you might right now say, oh no, I'm dating someone that makes me not. No, you're single, okay? You're either married or not married. That's our categories for today. And whatever category you're in, you would do very well. It would be very wise of you to figure out, what does God say life should be like for you in this space? Because what seems to happen is we try to figure out what we think it should look like. And if you look at the average marriage today that's being done the way that humans have come up with, it's a mess. It doesn't look like anything that honors God, nor does it look like anything that I want to be a part of. Okay? I bring up this verse a lot, but I think it's an important one. It's in Proverbs multiple times, but in Proverbs 14, it says that there's a way that seems right to a man. So there's a way that seems good to us, but in the end it leads to destruction. It leads to death. And that definitely can be seen in marriage, where people are, they're trying to do marriage their own way and it doesn't work out. And we saw this, the same idea that there's a way that seems right to people and in the end it doesn't work out. It leads to destruction. Last week in chapter 6, the second half of chapter 6, where Paul is really commanding and imploring, giving severe directions for the church in Corinth and therefore us too to stay away from sexual sin. And he reminded us at the very end of that, that we are bought at a price, right? Jesus, if we're born again, if we're Christians, bought us at the price of his blood. And therefore, we should be using our bodies to glorify God. And that was where we ended. And then today, we really focus in on the topic of marriage. And again, I realize many of you are not married, but some of you someday, I believe, desire to be married. So it would do you well to know what God says that should look like. And even if you don't, even if you stay single forever, this is still an important issue. Number one, because God has called you to live around married people, so you should know what that should look like. He's called you to be in a church that has married people, so you should know what marriage should look like. And lastly, this is important for every Christian, because in Ephesians, God makes it very clear that marriage is intended to be a reflection, a picture of the most important relationship that humans can be in, and that isn't with your spouse, but with Jesus. God says that marriage illustrates the relationship that Jesus has with his church, So regardless of your relationship status, this issue of marriage is a critical one that should not be ignored. Okay? It's a critical one that should not be ignored. So if you are in your Bible, go ahead and turn to 1 Corinthians 7, which probably everyone already did besides me. But we are in chapter 7, verse 1. Let me go ahead and just read a couple verses. It says, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband." So at the very start, Paul says, concerning the things that you wrote to me. And I've mentioned this before, But evidently, the Corinthian church had written a letter to Paul with some questions. Okay, they had some issues that they felt they needed clarification on, so they wrote Paul a letter, which kind of surprises me. Because when you read about this church, the fact that they actually had the humility and the wisdom to know that they should go to Paul for answers kind of surprises me. If I were to guess, and this is just my guess, more likely there was a couple wise people with the humility to do this, a couple people that probably knew the answers to this, and they needed Paul's authority to kind of say, well, we got this letter back from Paul, and I've been telling you this already, but now let me tell you what Paul said. That's my suspicion, which isn't worth a whole lot, but that's my guess. But they had some questions, and one of it has to do with the issue of marriage. And at this point in Corinth, there was two main viewpoints for the Christians on marriage, and specifically on sexual activity. Okay, and that is viewpoint number one. This was held by the group that would have called themselves the Epicureans, just to kind of keep them separate. And they believed that the spirit and the soul was totally separate from the body, which meant you could do anything you wanted with the body, and it had no impact on the soul, on the spirit. Meaning you could go and sin and do whatever you want with your body, and God didn't care. It had nothing to do with your standing before God. It had nothing to do with your obedience to God, because that was physical, not spiritual. So they thought you can go and sleep with whoever you want. You can basically commit any sin that you desire. And Paul had really dealt with that in chapter 6, right? That's what we saw last week. He said, stop that. You can't do that. That isn't right. God does not stand for this. Now, how they came up with that, how they could call themselves Christians and have that attitude that God doesn't care what you do, I really don't know. All I can say is we as humans are really, really, really good at finding excuses and justification for allowing us to do whatever sinful thing that we might desire to do. We're good at finding reasons why it's okay for us to do whatever sin God has clearly told us not to do. The fact is, God does care how we live. He does have a plan for us. He does have a will for us. And part of that is our righteousness, our holiness, our sanctification, becoming more and more like Jesus. So that was viewpoint number one, that you can do whatever you want because the body and soul, spirit are separate. Viewpoint number two was kind of the exact opposite, but they believed that there were spiritual things, and all of those spiritual things are good, and then all things physical were bad, meaning to give in to kind of any of your physical desires must be bad. So I would assume that people with that kind of attitude had really boring meals. They didn't have fun. These were the Stoics. So there's the Epicureans and the Stoics. So basically, what that means for the context of this chapter is they would have said, well, any kind of sex at any time, for any reason, with any person, even if it's your spouse, is not okay, because that's kind of a physical desire. So what's interesting is there's these two viewpoints, and I bet they were trying to figure out which one of these viewpoints is right. Is it viewpoint number one or viewpoint number two? The problem with that is neither of them are right. Neither are right. It wasn't number one. It wasn't number two. And Paul is going to kind of answer here, proving that all of their opinions, both sides of this, is wrong. So to begin, in his answer to this question that they had, he says it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, by that, he doesn't mean you're not supposed to shake hands. Okay, that's not what we're talking about here. Okay, this is dealing with sexual union. Specifically, it's dealing with marriage. Sexual union, becoming one, as we discussed last week. So as we saw last week, he had already kind of made this clear for those who are not married. And here now he's dealing with marriage. And he's going to explain why, when he says it's good for you not to touch, he'll explain why later in this chapter. We'll see it before we finish, and then we'll very clearly see it next week. But his reasoning for this is that if you get married, your attention is going to not be going to anymore be able to be fully on God, fully on serving Him, but it's going to be divided. It'll be partially on your spouse. Okay, and that's why he says that this is good, that it's good for there not to be this union. Which is interesting because that says here in verse 1, Paul's saying that marriage is not the end goal. Marriage is not the number one priority. And I say that because so often we think that's it. That's going to be what satisfies. That's what's going to be what fulfills. That's what being a good Christian is to get married. Well, that's not Paul's opinion. I'm not speaking against marriage here. I'm saying that that's not what leads to final satisfaction. And a lot of times Christianity, a lot of churches even, they teach the idea of family first. Okay, they push family first. And just so you know, that's not biblical. The Bible teaches Jesus first. Jesus first. You need to know that. We were discussing earlier about kind of the cultural pressures of family here. And the cultural pressures here is family's number one. It's not what the Bible teaches. Okay? It's not. So be careful that you don't allow culture's push for family to overrule the Bible's teaching on it, because Paul was aware that having that family relationship would take some of the time and the passion and the commitment that could have otherwise been given to God. However, here, Paul also realizes that there was a real problem with sexual immorality. We covered that last week, but it was a mess, right? It was a real mess. And the reality is, it still is today. It's not like, oh yeah, Corinth was a mess, but Cebu, there's no sexual sin in Cebu. No, it was bad in Corinth in the year 35 or wherever we're at this point. And it's bad here in Cebu 2,000 years later. Okay? Now, as we're going to see as we go here, Paul isn't saying by that phrase that all sex is bad. He's saying when it's taken out of the context that God designed it for, we covered last week, the committed legal marriage between one man, one woman, that covenant commitment, when it's taken out of that context, that's when it becomes a problem. But because there's so much sin and everything there, Paul advises that if this is an issue, this sexual sin, it would be better for you to marry someone, to have a spouse and a partner that makes this not only allowed, but he's going to say a good thing, a good thing. So in a very real way, what he's saying is since you can't control yourself, since you can't control your sexual desires, you should get a spouse so that those desires can be fulfilled in a way that is righteous and godly and pleasing to him. Okay, verse 3, he says, "Let the husband render to his wife the affection that is due to her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourself to fasting and to prayer, and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." So at this point, maybe I should have started with this warning, but at this point, I just have to say, if discussing this issue makes you uncomfortable, you're in for an uncomfortable 30 minutes because we're a church that we just go through the Bible, right? We started in the first chapter of Corinthians, and we've worked our way through, and here we are in chapter 7. And since we go through the Bible, we cover issues even that might make us uncomfortable. We don't skip past things because this is important stuff, or else God would not have provided it for us, right? So as a church that takes the Word of God seriously for all subjects, even this one, we won't avoid it. And I say that because I'm not really sure if in general Filipinos are more or less uncomfortable having this subject addressed in a public way than Americans. But let's face it, getting in a group together at church and talking about sex for 40 minutes can seem awkward. But that's what God has before us, so there you go. But what do these verses actually say? It says that married couples should have sex. It's not real complicated. That's what these verses are saying, that they should be physically intimate. It's actually a command. So sexual union in marriage isn't an option. It's not like an extra thing. It tells us that to sexually withhold yourself in marriage is sin, and to use sexual denial as a weapon in marriage is sin. It says there's to be no deprivation. You know what's interesting is when you read this, it's not talking about having kids. And I bring that up because sometimes in churches, they're like, oh, we can't talk about sex in any situation except that it's for making children. Right? If you didn't know, that's where babies come from. But read the Bible. The Bible actually says in marriage that procreation is one reason for sex, but not the only reason, and I would say not even the primary reason. Okay, there's plenty of support for the sexual union, the intimacy. You become one. Remember we talked about that last week, how in that act, there's a oneness that happens. So some Christians act as if this is only for children, and that would be to ignore the Bible. If you don't believe me, read Proverbs chapter 5, or you can read the Song of Solomon, which is a whole book that expresses in pretty clear, I don't know if graphic would be the right term, but pretty clear in almost graphic detail the nature of physical union between a husband and wife. Okay? And notice in Christian marriage, the spouses, the husband and the wife, have equal authority over each other's body. So when love is present, hear this, when love is present, this isn't a problem because you are more concerned with your spouse than you are yourself. But when the sinfulness of selfishness enters in, this can become an issue. So when we become a Christian, when you become a Christian, you are essentially making a vow and a commitment that will include the surrender of many of our individual rights to God. I shifted in case you didn't catch that. When you become a Christian, you're really committing yourself, letting go of a lot of your rights. You're saying, God, I want you to be in charge. Not only are you in charge, but I want you to be in charge now. And you're letting go of some of your individual rights and even some of your individual pursuits for his pursuits. And remember, marriage is a picture of the relationship that we have with Jesus. And when we become husband and wife, we're also, by design, intentionally giving up some of our own freedoms and our own desires for the other person. If you don't like that, don't get married. That's kind of my advice for anyone who doesn't like any of the expectations God puts on marriage. If you don't want to follow them, fine. Just stay single. Because if you're going to get married, you should do it God's way. If getting married means that you lose some control, you lose the ability to chase whatever you wish, You instead need to be committed and submitted to the other person. You better be really careful about who you marry. So, as I said, I know there's not a lot of married people in here today, which means there's a lot of single people that probably want to be married. Don't marry the wrong person. The Bible has plenty to say about this. We saw last week how the Christian is only to marry a believer, right? You're supposed to be equally yoked. Christians are only to marry a believer. But I believe it goes far beyond that. Some people act like this is no big deal. Like, oh, just get married, it'll work out. As long as you like her, it'll be okay. That's terrible advice. I'll go so far as to say that I think God has a person for you. If you're supposed to be married, I think he has a person for you. And he, if you are faithfully committed to following his lead, will bring you there. And how, you might say, well, how can you biblically support that? Well, because in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, it says that before we were born, God created specific works for you to do. Specific things for you to do. And I'm just guessing that you're probably going to do some of those works with your spouse, or at least your spouse's works probably need to be like in the same continent. That would probably be helpful. So that means you better find the person that God has for you, and don't be concerned about the finding. We'll talk about that later. But I believe this is a big deal, and people are foolishly just marrying whoever. They're letting their emotions lead them to make foolish decisions. I'm not saying your emotions shouldn't be involved. Like, oh, just, you should study and pick someone. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying don't be controlled by your emotions. We're going to get to it, but marriage is a forever thing here on this earth. So you're locked in. So don't take this flippantly. Get married to the right person. And when you do, you'll be very, very, very glad. And you get married to the wrong person, and you'll be very, very, very regretful. That's kind of a side thing, but to me it's an important issue, one that I'm not going to avoid. Okay, so if any of you are dating right now or wanting to date, be sure that you have considered this. And I hope it goes beyond appearance, because someday the person you're dating is going to get old and their appearance is going to change. But what we see in these verses is part of the covenant, the compact of marriage, is a promise to seek the fulfillment of the physical intimacy for the other person. And just so you know, the verb used is present and continuous. And all I bring that up for is when it's a present continuous, that's the tense of the verb. This means it's a continual thing. It's not like a one-time rare occurrence. So you can figure out what that means for yourself. Also, notice the word affection used in verse 3. Affection. So we are not just talking about the physical sexual activity, but to offer up everything that is needed for true oneness, unity, as we discussed last week, the closeness that's described by biblical marriage. You know what's kind of funny is last week, if you were going to summarize Paul's message to the Corinthian church last week and make it real simple, it was pretty much, hey, you should all stop having sex. That's basically what he was saying. And then what do we see this week? It's like, hey, if you're married, you should be having sex. That's his message. So it's interesting. First he's yelling that they shouldn't. Now he's saying, but you should if it is done in the right way with the one right person. And I'll tell you, there's research done on this, but there's an author who wrote this. He says, Satan's great strategy when it comes to sex is to do everything he can to encourage everyone outside of marriage to be having as much sex as possible, and then to discourage those inside of marriage from the unity that God intends. And then the author goes on to say that Satan gains victory, okay, that it's equal victory for him if he can accomplish either of those things. If I lost you there, that means that before you were married, which, unless I'm missing something for anyone here, that's you guys, Satan really wants you to have sex with people that he, you know, he doesn't really care who, as long as you're not married. And then once you're married, he doesn't want you to anymore because he wants to divide. He wants to devour. He wants to separate. He wants to destroy. What is clear here is that for the married people, you don't use physical union as a tool for punishment. In verse 5, it says, if there's going to be a stop, right? If there's going to be a stop to this, he says, let me tell you how it should happen. First of all, that you consent. Okay? Do not deprive one another except with consent. So you're coming together. So it's not where someone says, let me tell you what's going to happen. But there's an agreement by mutual consent. One doesn't inform the other, but both agree. Two, it happens for a limited time. Three, it happens for a clearly expressed purpose to devote yourself to prayer. And lastly, and then you come back together. Okay, then you're united again. Moving on, verse 6, it says, but I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. So what he means by this is, I'm not saying that you have to marry, but that you may if you wish and if it's God's will for your life. So he's not telling any single person that they have to get married. He's telling them that they may get married so that you don't need to listen to the people who were saying the only spiritual way to live your life is as a single person, singleness. So in these verses, he has been describing really the duties of the married, but he's not saying that that means everyone has to be married. So if you are married, once you are married, this is what's required, this is what's expected, this is what's healthy, this is what's good, this is what will lead to a good marriage that's godly. But if you don't want to listen to that, fine, just stay single. Again, if you don't like God's directions on this issue, you better stay single. And just so you know, if you are choosing, whether by God's will or your own, to stay single, that isn't settling for less. Okay? It isn't settling for less. In fact, in many ways, Paul would say that it's actually better. Verse 7, he says, for I wish that all men were even as myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. So now he's kind of stating his own preference, and he says, I wish that everyone would be like me, and then if you had just stopped at verse 7, you would say, well, like you, how? But in verse 8, he says, and I'm single. So he's saying, my preference, I wish that everyone would stay single, stay unmarried like me. And again, we'll talk about this a little more next week. But when we get to verse 32, we're going to see that when you are single, you have less distractions and less commitments. You are more freed to serve the Lord. Okay, if you have a spouse, you need to be concerned with them. If you didn't pay attention, I just called Chelsea a distraction. But if you were paying attention, you know that the Bible did it, not me. So, it's just a fact. I mean, this isn't something that can be debated. You have so many hours in your day, right? You have so many hours in your day, and if you're going to give any of them to a spouse, you have less hours to use for something else. And that isn't bad. It's not sin. In fact, many of you, it is probably God's will that you give those hours to someone else. I am totally convinced it was God's will for me to be married. 100% sure on that. So I'm not saying it's bad to be married, but I am saying it will change your life. And what I see is a lot of people that think they're so tied up to commitments when they're not married and they don't have kids, but they're in school, so they think they're so busy. And they look at the people that are not in school and they think, oh, you have so much free time. You're going to think I'm arrogant and wrong, but I'm telling you, you have no clue. There are certain commitments you have right now. A lot of you are students. I'm speaking specifically to you who are students. There are certain commitments you have right now. I realize that. I realize it interferes. But if you think it's going to just get so much easier when you get out of school, you're wrong. And just so you know, I was in school once. So I'm not just the old guy who doesn't know what he's talking about. Right now, you guys will probably say you believe me, but I really don't think you believe me. You'll see. You will. Life doesn't get less busy. It doesn't. Not if you're moving forward with God. Because guess what? If it does get less busy, God will give you more to do. Okay? He'll give you more to do. But again, it's just a math thing. This isn't an opinion. Well, if you're married, you have less time for God. It's true. You have so much attention. You have so much devotion. You have so much love. You can only give it so many places. And if this is true for a spouse, you also need to recognize that this is also true for children. Right? If a spouse takes time, children certainly do as well. Children may be a blessing in the Bible. There's plenty of evidence that children are a blessing of God. It might be God's will for your life to have children, but don't just go along with the often twisted idea that all Christians are supposed to have as many children as they possibly can. And you might say, oh, but there was that time where God said to go forth and multiply the earth. Yeah, he told Noah that. You know how many people were on the earth at that point? He also told Noah to build a giant boat. So if you're going to use that evidence, you better be building a really big boat. And I just say that because, again, you guys are here in a culture where people think you have to have children. I'm not against children. Okay, if that's God's will, you should have them. But don't just assume that you have to. Because so often we just go with what culture says. Well, I have to have children. Okay, if you have kids, they become a huge portion of your ministry. And it's not that you're neglecting ministry. It's not that you're neglecting serving the Lord. It's that your service has largely shifted to serving them, raising them, doing it in a way that is honoring God. So you need to think about this. You need to think about this. And seek God's will for your life. But you notice in these verses, Paul says, whether you're married or you're single, it's a gift from God. Now, maybe there are some single people that see that singleness as a gift. I believe there are some people that recognize that. I can tell you that I was single at one time, and I didn't see it as a gift from God. Because I wanted to be married. I failed to see the gift that God had given me at that time. And that very well could be some of you, okay? It could be you as well. But here he says, not that marriage is a gift, but that whatever state you're in, married or single, it's a gift from God. Well, how is it a gift from God? Well, many ways, but one way it's a gift is that God will use it, whether you're married or single, whichever one, for your growth. For your sanctification. If you're single, God might use it to make you patient. Okay, he's going to use whatever situation you're in to teach you things, to sanctify you, bring you closer to him. If you're married, he will do it as well. He'll help you see how selfish you are. You'll see it real quick. So whatever situation you're in, God will use it in your life. And I bring that up because sometimes we're so thinking that whatever the other situation is might be better, right? If you're single, so I just want to get married, and you don't see the situation you're in as a gift from God, you don't appreciate it, and therefore you don't learn the lessons that God is teaching you, you're so focused and distracted on finding the right person to marry that you never give any thought to becoming the right person that someone could marry. I believe that if you're following God, you follow God, you commit to Him, you surrender to Him, He'll bring you where you need to be. I believe that. So instead of being totally preoccupied with that, why don't you be totally preoccupied with becoming the person God wants you to be? And if you think of what marriage is, and I'll speak especially to the men, although this is true for everyone, as men, you're called to lead your family. You're called to lead your wife. God is a really good father, and I have my doubts that He's going to entrust one of His daughters to you until you have learned the lessons you need to learn. So if you want to get married, what you probably should do is figure out, what does the Bible say about what a godly man or woman is? Seek to be that. Seek to be that. Also, you need to know that if you have no desire to be married, you don't have this issue he's talking about with self-control. You're like, I could be single. That's okay. You could do great things for God. If you read some of the Christian, especially missionary biographies, but there's plenty of other ones, a lot of them were single. And they did some really impressive stuff. They really served the Lord in big ways. So see this time as a gift and use it how God desires. Use that for God. Give God the undivided attention that you have to give to Him. But he says if you're unable to have self-control, if you're burning with passion is the words, then you should get married. Because what happens is sometimes those who don't have the self-control and they're burning with passion, they're so focused on finding the person that it's not as if they have undivided attention for God, because the reality is they're putting all their attention on finding someone to be married, and if they actually just got married, they would probably have more time and more attention to commit to God because they would stop being so distracted. So get married, and then you can give that time to serve the Lord, meaning then you'll actually be better for God because of your marriage. And I really believe that. If God's called you to be married, you will be a better servant of Him because of it. Just so you know, I couldn't do what God's called me to apart from Chelsea. Okay? So if something happens to Chelsea, I'm probably leaving. Just find a new pastor. Not because I'm abandoning you, but because I'll be no good to you. Now maybe God will change. I don't want to speak for God. I'm just saying, you will. Shut up, Rodney. I just learned how to say shut up in Messiah. Hilombai. I say this because there's so many people that when they start dating, you should care about the person you're dating. You should give them attention. If you don't, that's weird. That's wrong. But if you start dating and all of a sudden you're just useless to God and you forgot about God and you compromised on your service to God, then there's a problem. You should be better together. If when you get married, all of a sudden you abandon the church, there's something weird about that. And I've seen it happen. So just if you ever want me to be, supportive of your relationship, if you ever want me to be supportive of any kind of relationship, I need to see evidence that you guys are good for each other. You hold each other accountable. You'll challenge each other. You like each other. You actually have fun together, but you also stir each other up to greater service, greater commitment to God. That's what good relationships should do. They push you closer to God, and you do that together. And if that's not happening, if that isn't happening in a relationship, I don't care how much fun you're having. I don't care how cute the person is and whatever other standard you're using. Don't expect me to be supportive of it. I can tell you I certainly will not be the one to do the wedding if that's what I see. I got all distracted by telling Rodney to shut up. What's interesting here also is Paul says he's single. He's like, everyone should be single just like me. Have you ever thought about Paul and his relationship status? Maybe you haven't. But I thought about this quite a bit this week as I read and I studied and learned what I could. And here's what I found out. In Philippians, you find that Paul was, he says, the Jew of the Jews. Like, he was as Jew as it could get. He was as orthodox as could be. Well, to really be fulfilling all of the Jewish expectations, you were married. Okay, around 18, you got married. That's just what was expected of you. And more strong evidence than that is in Acts chapter 26, we learn that Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin. That was a council. And the Sanhedrin, it was required to be married. So we have every reason to understand that at one time Paul was married and now he's not. Right? At one time Paul was married, now he's not. Well, why is that? Why is that? And there's really two possibilities. Number one, she died. His wife died. That certainly could have happened. Number two might be that on the Damascus Road, when Paul was converted and he committed himself to Jesus, she wasn't so supportive of that. That could be what happened. He's going to write about that in the last section of our passage for today. So what really happened? I don't know. In heaven, okay, if you're a Christian, you get to heaven, you can go and ask Paul, hey, were you actually married? Or were we all guessing on this for nothing? And you can ask him, because I can't really tell you the answer, but I bring this up just because what he's writing was personal to him. Okay, if he was married, this was a personal thing for him. This was reality to him. And if it was that she kind of abandoned him on as a result of his Damascus Road experience when he encountered Jesus and was converted, then what he's going to write to the Corinthians, as we're going to see a little bit later on, that if you come to faith in Jesus and your marriage partner won't have anything to do with you anymore, you better let them go, let them depart. Maybe he wasn't just writing theory. Maybe he was writing history. Maybe he was writing his biography. Again, just speculation. We don't know. But what we do know for sure is that Paul wanted others to remain unmarried because he believed if they stayed single, they could live the same focus that he had. So singleness for Paul gave him clarity of his purpose. It kind of structured his life. He lived with the mindset of Philippians 3:14, this one thing that I do, I forget what is behind and I press on. So Paul saw that his life as a single person, allowed him to pursue the mission that God called him to with great intensity. Great intensity. And I bring that up because otherwise you might just say, oh yeah, I'm single, but that's good because Paul said, I wish you were single like me. No, he's saying, I wish you were single like me so that you would live a life of serious intensity to pursue God's purposes and plans. So if you're just like, well, I'm single and Paul said that's a good thing, if it's not accompanied with the serious intensity of pursuing God's purposes and plans, I think you're missing the point. Verse 10, now to the married, right? Because he said the single people, it might be a good idea for you to stay singled. Now to the married, I command you, not I, but the Lord. So he wants to make it very clear that we understand this isn't his opinion, but this is direct teaching from God. Not I, but the Lord. A wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. So basically, he has now addressed the single people in chapter 6 and told them to stop having sex. Then he addressed the Christian married people and he said, you guys should be having sex. And then to the people who are single, he says, you guys could stay single and serve the Lord. And now we come to this other category of married people where one of the partners is a believer and one is an unbeliever. Now, as far as I know, none of you are in this situation. And if none of you are in this situation right now, none of you ever need to be in this situation. And I would hope and pray and whatever other stronger word I could come up with, command, but I don't get to command. But I'm begging you that you don't put yourself in this. Do not find yourself here. But if you do, and I'll tell you, I've known people that I believe were committed to God, believed with great confidence they were marrying someone else who was committed to God, and found later on that that commitment did not remain and they abandoned the faith. So people do find themselves in this situation, even when they're doing their best to follow the lead of God. But if you find yourself here, he makes it clear that you don't abandon that person. It says, don't depart. Don't depart. And I think he uses the word depart there on purpose, and I didn't look into the official language. I don't know what it is in Greek. But you have the word depart there in verse 10, and then divorce in verse 11. I think he uses depart because, just so you know, you can depart your spouse without divorcing your spouse. And in the Philippines, you guys try to do that by just renaming divorce annulment, which is a way that you can get divorce and not feel guilty about it. God's not behind that. Divorce is illegal. And since divorce is illegal, then people do annulments where they can file enough paperwork to say that the marriage was never actually real in the first place. Which, you know what God calls that? Divorce. So I don't care what the lawyers say. And also, again, you can depart and stay married. You can depart and even stay, you could still be living in the same house. You're married, but there's no unity. There's no affection. But what he's saying is, you don't abandon. And there's exceptions. Okay, Matthew 19, Jesus gave exceptions. He said, if there's adultery, you're allowed out. But the idea here is you're to remain committed to each other. And why is that? Well, first of all, remember what marriage is to do? Marriage is to show us the relationship that God has with his people. Do you know that Jesus doesn't abandon you? Okay, he doesn't abandon you. Even when it's not fun anymore, he doesn't abandon you. He doesn't abandon you because he starts to like someone else more. Doesn't abandon you when life gets hard. He remains faithful to us. He remains committed to us. He remains loving to us. Through everything, he doesn't abandon us. So what do we see here? We are to stay faithful. And just so you know, that doesn't just mean you stay putting up with one another. There are people who are like, well, we're never going to get divorced. We're going to stay together. But you don't. You hate each other. You can't stand each other. You don't actually fight to make things better. You don't fight for love. You just are satisfied that you didn't legally file the paperwork to separate. No, that's not what we're talking about. You're to stay united, to stay faithful, to stay committed. So it's not just that you put up with one another. And that's even when you're old. You know what I think is fun to see? Is the couples that are like 80 years old and they still have fun together. You just tell us, like, they actually like each other. And you know what I think is really sad? When you see the 50-year-olds together out shopping, and you can tell they just can't stand each other. That's not what Christian marriage is supposed to be. Now, if you're in that, you stay committed and you try to work through it. I'm saying that that shouldn't be the goal in marriage. It means fighting for a good marriage, staying in love, staying actually liking each other. Don't let the busyness become an excuse for a bad marriage. Don't let children become an excuse for a bad marriage. And when you don't do that, when you don't fight for a good marriage, remember, your marriage is showing what a relationship with Jesus looks like. So when you don't fight for a good marriage, you're showing the world that a relationship with Jesus is not very good. That's the example you're giving to the world. sometimes you're given an example that is not worth fighting for, that is boring, and it shouldn't be that. Shouldn't be that. Verse 12, but to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife. So here you can see Paul saying, and now this is my opinion, it's not God saying this. There's great debate on this. I'll tell you that I don't believe that this is saying that God isn't behind this, that you can just skip this verse because this is just what Paul has to say. I believe it's that Jesus didn't clearly teach this before. You know, there hasn't been the clear teaching from God, but here it is now in the Bible. So you can make your decision on that, but I'm gonna listen to Paul. I think he knows what he's talking about. But he says, but to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. So stay together. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. So again, he's saying, he's giving this clear teaching. If you're a believer and your spouse isn't, if they're willing to stick it out with you, if they're not going to abandon you, stay with them. Stay in that situation. And it's not going to be easy. Just so you know, I know people in this situation. It's not easy. It's got great challenges. And yet Paul says you should stay there. And he tells you why in verse 14. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will not save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will not save your wife? So he says that the unbelieving partner will be sanctified by the believing partner. This doesn't mean, okay, this does not mean that they will automatically be saved. Like, well, if you're a Christian and you're married to an unbeliever, they'll for sure be saved. I wish it did mean that. But everyone must individually put their faith in Christ, and no family member can do that for someone else. But it does mean that the way that the believing partner lives should be done in such a way that it has a profound impact and effect on their unbelieving spouse. They should see the way you live, the peace you have, the joy you have, the relationship with God that you have, and say, I need what you have. There's something different about you, and I want it. So you live in a way that you are impacting them, that you are actually being the light to the world that we're called to be. You live in a way, your faith is displayed in a way that they will be attracted to God, to what you have. Now, what sometimes happens is instead of you impacting them, instead of the believer impacting the unbeliever, they allow the unbeliever to impact them. And they become bitter towards God, upset with God. No, that's not what happens. You are to impact them. You're supposed to contaminate them. Don't let them contaminate you. Okay, when Jesus touched the sick, he didn't catch their sickness. He healed them. But just so you know, it's not guaranteed. It's not guaranteed. And that's why Paul says some of them, they simply will not have it. They don't want anything to do with it. They don't want anything to do with you. They don't want anything to do with the Lord that you're following. They don't want anything to do with the faith that you have. They will despise you and they will despise God. And Paul says, let them go. If they're going to leave, nothing you can do. But, I mean, what are you going to do? Like, tie them up? That's not okay. Okay? What do you do? They've abandoned you. They want nothing to do with God. They don't want nothing to do with you. Let them go. And he says, you're not at fault. You're not at fault. It's not sin. It's out of your control. Now, I'll end just with a warning, marriage done God's way is a great, great blessing. Marriage done apart from the will of God, a terrible curse, be miserable. I bet if I asked you how many of you have seen a bad, miserable marriage, I bet everyone here could raise their hand. You don't want that. You don't want that. Singleness, done God's way, can be really fulfilling. Really fulfilling. It can be a great thing. Singleness done your own way, not so much. Not so much. I'll warn you again, Satan, he wants to steal, kill, and destroy. Okay? He wants to break up marriages. He wants to destroy the purpose of singleness. Don't let him. Don't let him.